The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, How to Fix the Government, by Nicholas Bagley. If you want to rebuild America, start with its code. Things did not go smoothly when, as the coronavirus pandemic took hold in spring of 2020, Congress turned to the unemployment system to help people who found themselves out of work. The under-resourced state agencies that carry out the day-to-day administration of the unemployment system would now have to get tens of billions of dollars into the pockets of the newly unemployed, which, by and large, they did. But they also had to avoid making payments to grifters who didn't qualify. That proved more difficult. Consider Michigan, the state where I live. In pre-COVID times, Michigan's unemployment agency would wait at least 10 days before paying a claim to allow the agency to verify an applicant's work history. During the pandemic, with claims skyrocketing, Michigan officials came under intense bipartisan pressure to get money out the door faster. As part of that effort, the agency decided the 10-day hold wasn't strictly essential. Even without it, an automated system called Fraud Manager would still review every claim and flag suspicious ones. That was the plan, at least. But, as is typical with technical matters, the agency had contracted out responsibility for running Fraud Manager. And the contractor, unbeknownst to the agency, had set Fraud Manager to run only in the evenings. That approach worked fine when the 10-day hold was in place, because Fraud Manager would inevitably run before any claim was paid. When the 10-day hold was eliminated, however, the agency started to pay claims the same day they were received, before Fraud Manager could review them. It took the state employment agency more than 2 months to notice the problem, according to a subsequent audit by Deloitte. In the meantime, the agency paid out an estimated $1.5 billion, that's billion with a B, in claims that should have been flagged for possible fraud. What's wild about this story isn't the absurdity of the mistake or its outsized financial consequences. What's wild is that it's completely typical. Every state unemployment agency struggled with fraud claims. Notoriously, a rapper known as Nuke Bizzle bragged about scamming California for more than $1.2 million. He is now serving a 6-year prison sentence. The Inspector General of the U.S. Labor Department estimates that as much as $163 billion in pandemic-related unemployment benefits shouldn't have been paid. And the issue isn't just unemployment insurance. As Jennifer Palko explains in her indispensable new book, Recoding America, similar tech problems plague government across nearly every program and at all levels, federal, state, and local alike. Addressing those tech problems would not only help us avoid billion-dollar mistakes in the future, it is also crucial, Palka argues, to the broader project, one that is starting to catch the attention of both pundits and policymakers, of improving the government's capacity to do what we have collectively asked of it. Palka is a former deputy in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, and the founder of Code for America, a nonprofit that aims to help government agencies with their tech issues. She excels at describing in cogent, accessible prose why government is so bad at tech. That sounds like it should be easy. It's not. You need someone with technical expertise and an insider's understanding of how a complex system operates at the line level. But you also need someone who can understand the policy and political forces that have shaped the system and can see how the lessons from one program might generalize to other programs. Palka has all that, and what makes her account so forceful and what will make it ring true for anyone who has worked in government is that it's not a story about bumbling civil servants or venal politicians. It's not even that the government can't afford to hire people with the needed tech skills. Instead, it's about the structures and incentives that make it more attractive for agencies to check bureaucratic boxes than to design usable tech. When you apply for food stamps, for example, you have to demonstrate that you're eligible. But in some of the applications have swollen to absurd lengths. Michigan's used to be 40 pages long and asked detailed, confusing, ridiculous questions about applicants' financial situation. A lot of people give up before they finish, even if they're eligible. In the old days, that was a literal paperwork problem. Now that applications have moved online, it's a problem with code, and the user experience is not top of mind for many government coders. At the tail end of her time in the White House, Palka was trying to convince a career bureaucrat over at the Office of Management and Budget that simplicity had to be the watchword when it came to digital services. To drive her argument home, she pointed to some of these food stamp applications, which, among many other things, asked if applicants owned any burial plots. Why on earth, she asked, does government want to know about burial plots? The bureaucrat was unmoved. Yes, he knew all about the burial plots. He used to work at the agency that oversaw the food stamp program and had written the regulations about burial plots. Why would he call for including such an inane question on forms that were already far too long? Congress said to assess their assets, he said. A burial plot is an asset. He was going to follow his instructions to the letter. The consequences be damned. For Palka, this checkbox mentality is at the root of much government dysfunction. We have a pension in the United States for holding civil servants accountable, not for the quality of the public services they provide, but for strict compliance with programmatic requirements. When the Inspector General comes knocking, that's what's evaluated. So too with courts. It's not their job to take a holistic view of whether the agency is doing its job effectively. They ask whether the agency has jumped through any of the prescribed procedural hoops. In prior work, I've railed about the way this procedural fetish in American law has hampered effective governance. Palka brings to vivid life how a cover-your-butt culture that prizes legalistic compliance above all else is especially pernicious for government tech. Policymakers layer requirement upon requirement without considering whether the benefits of complexity outweigh the costs. Even when policymakers give agencies some flexibility, the bureaucracy often transforms suggestions into rigid requirements, which are then slavishly followed. The public interest gets forgotten along the way. In other words, Palka's book isn't just about tech. It's about the American administrative state, and it's a call for paring back the rigid rules that make it so hard to govern and for rebuilding government's ability to do its job effectively. In this, Palka joins ranks with the likes of Brink Lindsey, Misha Shalom, Alex Stapp, and Ezra Klein, who are all beating a similar drum about the need to improve the government's ability to meet our collective aspirations. This nascent state capacity movement, also known as supply side or abundance progressivism, has arisen in response to the urgency of the housing crisis, the massive land use changes needed to pivot to renewable energy, and the exorbitant costs of new public transit. Palka would add to that list the deplorable performance of government tech. We need a government that can build, whether it's wind farms or websites. How we get there from here is a hard question. For now, the movement's origin in housing, renewables, and transit means that it's associated with the political left. Its emphasis on construction and deregulation, however, means it holds some bipartisan appeal. Maybe there's room for progress out of the limelight. For her part, Palka doesn't see government capacity as an especially partisan issue. Big problems with government tech, she argues, typically arise because of implementation failures that both Republicans and Democrats would like to avoid. That's a departure from the conventional account on the left. Return to the story of the unemployment insurance that I opened with. Part of the reason the tech worked so badly is because of decades of underinvestment in a safety net program that Republicans dislike. In other words, the problem was not just implementation, it was also a kind of sabotage. As Jerusalem Demnas here at The Atlantic has written, state capacity is downstream of ideological commitments. When we have political consensus, we have state capacity. When we don't, we don't. Demsis is certainly on to something. Better tech is harder for programs that face political headwinds. Palka doesn't disagree, but she suggests that we can sidestep some of the deeper challenges, for now, by focusing on the relatively low salience domain of policy implementation. Food stamp applications didn't ask those in need about burial plots to harass them or to surreptitiously shrink the food stamps program. It was just really bad implementation. Which is another way of saying that there are some low-hanging fruits to pluck if we care enough to try. Implementation, Palka writes, can't be beneath the attention of our most powerful institutions, and it can't be beneath our attention as a public. When Americans no longer see government websites as laughingstocks, when applications to ask sensible questions, when submitting your taxes online is easy, when signing up for health insurance doesn't require a PhD, maybe the politics will follow. You've got to start somewhere. Now, Movies Are Best Before Noon by Jeff Leloisier. My love of going to the movies during the day began with my job. As a magazine editor tasked in the 2010s with finding entertainment stories, I often attended film screenings for journalists, many of which were scheduled for the early morning so that we could get to writing afterward. At first, I viewed these excursions as merely a professional obligation. I would walk into the screening bleary-eyed, coffee and pastry in hand, and slump into my seat. And yet each time I emerged from the dark theater some 2 hours later, I felt revitalized, ready to take on the day. If the life wisdom espoused by self-improvement columns and my grizzled colleagues was, do the hardest thing first, I was taking the opposite approach. I was beginning my day doing the most pleasurable thing. It was, quite literally, an eye-opener. Nearly a decade later, my soft spot for matinees remains. Although I'm no longer working as an editor, I still utilize weekends and holidays for early jaunts to the theater whenever I can. These showings have numerous advantages over their evening counterparts. Tickets are typically cheaper, for one. Daytime movie audiences also tend to be more relaxed and to go alone. Walk into an 11 a.m. screening of Shazam! Fury of the Gods, and you'll find yourself among kindred spirits, people in sweats who've chosen to start their day in the space between public and private, hiding out from the larger world while still taking part in it. Earlier in the day, before many of life's obligations have a chance to weigh on you, movie-going can be an even greater sensory feast than usual. One can more easily pay attention to the flavor of the rich buttery popcorn, to the oxblood velvet of the seats, to the tiny white aisle lights twinkling invitingly like an airport runway. The luxury of time sprawling out before you makes everything feel elevated. Most of all, when I get to start the day with a film, I am reminded that culture is an integral part of life. Often my weeknight Netflix consumption is a necessary form of self-absentia, a passive consumer experience meant to rid myself of the day's stresses. By that time, I'm just looking for a soft landing. But the rare joy of a matinee foregrounds a movie as something worth my utmost attention. I'm hardly the only one who feels this way. As a composition student at Juilliard in the 1940s, the American philosopher Stanley Cavell frequently skipped classes and instead went to the movies during the day. These trips left such an impression on Cavell that he would later write, "Memories of movies are strand over strand with memories of my life." Many times a movie before noon can be a guilty pleasure, like cake for breakfast. Other times the clarity of the morning can lead to moments of genuine introspection through cinema. And then there are instances when the film itself matters less than the time that the matinee facilitates with friends and family. Case in point, Some years ago, my father told me he'd begun experiencing lapses in his short-term memory and was contemplating seeing a doctor. A retired physics teacher who'd made his living explaining complex scientific concepts, he was starting to find even simple ideas difficult to articulate. When I gave him a book for his birthday, a bulging spy novel by the author Daniel Silva that my mother had suggested, he turned it over in his hands, seemingly confused by how it had gotten there. It would be years before we had an official diagnosis, but we knew that my once brilliant father was in decline. People with dementia tend to be a little sharper in the mornings than at night, so my family began scheduling outings early in the day, including going to the movies. That first winter, we avoided most of the crush of holiday movie crowds by catching a 10:30 a.m. screening of Star Wars: The Force Awakens. A storm had dumped several inches of snow on southeastern Wisconsin, but we still made it in time to grab coffees from the concession stand before taking our seats. Afterward, while standing on the curb and warily eyeing the icy parking lot, I asked my dad what he thought of the film. "Best one so far," he said. I can't say I agreed, but who cares? I realized at that moment that it didn't much matter whether Han died or Leia lived, or even if my dad remembered who those characters were. In the comfortable silence of the theater, we had sat side by side and traveled to another galaxy, all before lunch. We stepped out, blinking in the midday sun, marveling at how much time we had left. Our third article is entitled "The Problem with Splitting Parental Leave Down the Middle" by Stephanie H. Murray. In 2018, when the Norwegian government announced plans to increase fathers' parental leave by 5 weeks, many Norwegians were thrilled. Nina Mikkelsen, a mother whose then one-year-old was still nursing, wasn't one of them. In Norway, paid parental leave is divided into three parts, some reserved for the mother, some for the father, and a third portion that can be used by either parent. Increasing the father's share meant cutting down on the shareable portion, effectively reducing the amount leave available to mothers by more than a month. And there was talk among some government officials of going further, getting rid of the third discretionary bucket altogether. Mikkelsen posted about her frustrations in a breastfeeding support Facebook group and found them shared by a number of other women. So she created a new group devoted to protesting the father quota called Permisjon Bunde Forte Fortelle, or leave should be taken, or should be shared, by parents, reflecting the group's primary goal, that every family be able to divide their leave as they see fit. The group became active in the comments sections of articles reporting on the reform. After the policy went into effect, the press took interest, and the movement against the father quota gained notoriety under a simplified name, Leave Rebellion. Paid parental leave has a long history in Europe. Its original purpose was to protect the health of both mother and child. But over the past few decades, encouraging fathers to take leave has become a priority in many countries. The goal is to promote gender equality in the labor market through promoting gender equality in the division of household work. Libertad Gonzalez, an associate professor of economics at Universitat Pompeu Fabra, told me, "In regions all over the world, mothers are more likely than fathers to leave their jobs or reduce their hours at some point after having kids, which significantly reduces their lifetime earnings. The hope is that if more fathers take leave, employers will be less likely to discriminate against women in hiring and promotions, and men will contribute more at home, freeing up mothers to give more time and energy to work. The problem is that getting dads to take paternity leave is quite difficult. Making parental leave gender neutral is not enough. In the European countries, as well as in Canada and Australia, where leave is shared or transferable between parents, it's overwhelmingly taken by mothers. The issue is not necessarily that fathers don't want to take leave. Anecdotal evidence suggests that many fear professional consequences for doing so, And strong cultural norms still reinforce the idea that women should be primary caregivers, Gonzalez told me. Many countries have started giving parents a little choice in the matter, reserving some amount of leave specifically for fathers on a use-it-or-lose-it basis. The so-called father quota acts as a progressive lever that encourages families to break from the traditional mold, Gonzalez said. Norway is the birthplace of this approach. The country converted its maternity leave to gender-neutral parental leave, most of which could be split between parents as desired, in 1978. But few fathers took any. So in 1993, Norway implemented 4 weeks of paid parental leave just for dads, and within a few years, most dads were taking it. Sweden did the same thing 2 years later, and both countries have expanded their father quotas over time. Many other countries have since followed suit, but there's little consensus on how much leave ought to be reserved for fathers. Some groups believe that all leave ought to be equally and non-transferably divided between parents. Only through what advocates call co-responsibility of care, the argument goes, can modern societies ever hope to achieve real gender equality. The European Union put out a directive that came into effect last year requiring all of its member states to provide both mothers and fathers with 4 months of each of parental leave, 2 months of which must be paid and non-transferable. But through equalizing parental leave seems like a straightforward win for gender equality at home and at work. Reserving leave for fathers is not without trade-offs. By design, it leaves couples little choice in how to divvy up their leave, which can pose challenges, mostly for women. Not everyone is on board with such a rigid approach. The Nordic region has become a model of gender equality for the rest of Europe for good reasons. Anne-Sophie Duvander, a demography professor at Stockholm University and an expert on fathers' use of parental leave, told me, Norway, Sweden, and Iceland all have very high rates of female labor force participation, which has been true since before the father quota was implemented. But the quota has likely improved gender equality in the labor market in other direct and indirect ways. Teasing out the degree to which it is responsible for improving women's career advancements and earnings is tricky. Its impact likely manifests gradually and works in conjunction with other family policies. But from Duvander's perspective, the father quota is undeniably having an effect. If you can't see that, you're living in another reality, she said. Elsewhere, however, the intended benefits of paternity leave have been slow to materialize. But at least so far, the expansion of paternity leave hasn't had much of a lasting effect on women's employment. Mothers are still far more likely to take unpaid leave or work part-time after their paid leave is up. Meanwhile, men are taking the leave, and then they're going back to work at the same pace as before. We see no big impact in terms of gender gaps and labor market outcomes at a societal level, Gonzalez told me. And there may have been some unintended consequences. The paternity leave did seem to help equalize employment outcomes within a subset of couples, but those couples also went on to have fewer kids overall. Expanding the father quota doesn't necessarily make life easier for mothers. Not all men take the leave reserved for them. This is especially true in countries where leave is poorly paid and in those with more traditional gender norms. But even in highly gender egalitarian Nordic countries where leave is fully compensated, a non-trivial portion of men don't use it. The ones who don't are usually those with the least education and income. Increasing paternity leave does nothing to help a mother whose partner won't take it and could actively make her life harder if it comes at the expense of leave she might otherwise take. Even in cases where a father is willing and able to take some leave, some mothers would prefer to take that time themselves, in many cases because they are still recovering from childbirth or still nursing. In Spain, some mothers resent the government's decision to devote public resources to expanding paternity leave when they feel like they don't have enough leave themselves. A group of feminist mothers called the Asociación Petra Maternidades Feministas has argued, among other things, that the government ought to prioritize lengthening the paid leave available to mothers to enable them to breastfeed exclusively for 6 months, as the World Health Organization recommends. In Norway, where mothers have up to about 7 months of fully paid leave, the women of Leave Rebellion feel this results in too little time to make the transition from breastfeeding to bottles and pumping or formula and solids. The last couple of weeks of your leave will be very stressful, Martha Lilleborg, a founding member of the group, told me. Some women work jobs where pumping or taking breaks to nurse is not possible or practical. Parents can extend their time off with unpaid leave, something a rising number of Norwegian women are doing, but lose some employee benefits such as pension contributions. A survey undertaken in 2021 to investigate the rise in Norwegian mothers taking unpaid leave found that, on average, fathers are content with a quota of 15 weeks. Women say it should be shortened to 11. Duvander told me that people seem most happy with the father quota in Sweden. On average, men there actually take more leave than is earmarked for them. But that could have something to do with the fact that leave there is so generous. Even with 3 months reserved for fathers, mothers are able to take more than a year if they choose. The longer the leave, the more likely women will be willing to share it, Duvander said. Ensuring both that all birth mothers feel their needs are met and that fathers and mothers take leave in equal measure would likely require giving both parents a lot of leave, which may be out of the reach for governments with limited budgets. But not everyone agrees that a perfect 50-50 split of leave ought to be the goal. The experience of the newborn period, like pregnancy or childbirth itself, is inherently unequal. Leaving the choice of how to split up parental leave to each couple and allowing for the possibility of gender unequal division is, in their view, the equitable approach. In that sense, the father quota has become a battleground for feminists with differing visions of equality. Mikkelsen suspects that although Leave Rebellion failed to reverse Norway's 2018 leave reform, it seems to have successfully quelled momentum towards splitting Norway's parental leave down the middle. But in Norway and elsewhere, the father quota will likely to continue to divide mothers. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.